This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 287 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vederhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hey, David. I tell you, it's going to be hard to concentrate on unmanned aircraft right now, considering that over the course of the past week, I've been to, a number of aviation museums. I've been to Viking Air up in British Columbia. Today, I took a press ride on a C-47 along with eight others in formation. It's just been quite an exciting week or so, David.
Well, you deserve it. You've been listening to all of us on all the other shows do this stuff all this time. So now you get to do it. So I'm happy for you, but we got to crack down and focus. We didn't do an episode last week, so sorry, teacher, but we got to get our butts in gear. Let's take a few minutes, and I believe we'll get started with an interview you did a couple weeks ago down on another one of your road trips to Florida.
That's right. This was recorded at Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida, in the first week of April. And this is my conversation with Michael Zebahazy from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And he talks about their unmanned systems programs and about a very interesting drone they used as a teaching device, something that comes from UAV Factory. So here's my conversation with Mike. Well, it's no surprise that Embry-Riddle is here at Sun and Fun, and I'm speaking with Mike Zebahazy. He's the UAS Flight Training and Standards Manager. Mike, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. This is a great show. Have you been to Sun and Fun yourself before?
I've been here for fun, and this is my first time working it.
Yeah, it's different when you're working the booth, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit different on the exhibitor side, yep.
So tell us a little bit about the program at Embry-Riddle as relates to UAS.
Sure. So we offer a full Bachelor of Science program in Unmanned Aircraft System Science. And that four-year degree program allows our students to kind of go through a crawl, walk, run sort of program where they learn on smaller programs. They learn the Part 107 regs. They go, they take their tests, they get their remote pilot certificate, and they move up from there to learn some multi-rotor stuff and go into smaller fixed wing options and learn the industry around that. And then eventually they move up to what we have here, which is the Penguin C aircraft that we got from UAV Factory, where we're going to actually set up a unmanned flight line. And we have a new catalog out that just came out this year with new classes to where they get to learn how to maintain the aircraft, they learn the systems around the aircraft, and they'll actually go out, set up a site, fly some training missions, and go get some time on the aircraft itself and the autopilot system.
That'd be a great experience for anybody that's looking to progress in this industry. Tell us a little bit about the hardware.
Sure. So the hardware with these guys, once you get to this level, they're an aircraft that's still under 55 pounds. They're using a two-stroke engine that runs off of a oil and fuel mixture, and that aircraft can hold about 5 liters of fuel, and it can run for about 20 hours if we want it to. We're going to do a little bit shorter training missions than that, but it has that ability, and it has a pretty unique system for launch and recovery. It's got a pneumatically controlled launcher where we set pressures according to the weights and the speeds that we want to launch the aircraft at. And then when it recovers under a parachute canopy with an airbag underneath the aircraft to kind of cushion the landing. So students are going to learn all that, a little bit about parachutes, the launch recovery system, the hardware around that. And then the aircraft itself, when it's up flying, they're going to be flying a camera that's going to be a daytime camera. And then they'll move up to a daytime and IR kind of nighttime camera combination. So they'll learn the theory behind that, learn some search and rescue techniques, some fire spotting, some scanning techniques while they're up flying.
Oh, and this, of course, is fixed wing. What's the wingspan? The one that we're looking at here doesn't have the wing on it, but what's the wingspan?
Yep, so the wingspan is just under 11 feet at 10.8 feet. It's about 7 feet long.
And this comes from the drone factory?
So it comes from UAV Factory.
UAV Factory,
yep.
Sorry.
It's a company based in Latvia. and they provide a product that's kind of a commercially available off-the-shelf product where they you get a configuration where you can buy the aircraft, the airframe, everything comes with it, the engine, and then you can get a payload that fits up front. They actually provide payloads, camera systems, retract mechanisms as well. Or you can, if you want to put any sort of other camera that you find in the marketplace that can fit up front, you can throw that camera up front too if it's in the 5 to 6 pound range.
How about the interest from the students? Are you seeing an increase in the number of people interested in this program?
So we just rolled it out, and we're kind of pushing the marketing on it a lot. So we're hoping to see that enrollment kind of go up. But we've held pretty steady as one of the bigger programs on campus. We're sixth or seventh biggest program right now. And the students who are around and kind of in the lab and working with us now, they're excited to see these aircraft and get more of a hands-on aspect in that fixed wing, a little bit bigger aircraft side of it. So
Mike, what's your background with the unmanned aircraft?
Sure. So my background, I actually graduated from Embry-Riddle back in 2010. So I did the Aviation Maintenance Science program.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And when I came out of there, I worked in general aviation for a while, doing maintenance on general aviation aircraft, kind of around the area. And then eventually I moved up to, I worked for Textron for a few years, working with their unmanned aircraft systems, working with their Aerosonde system, which is very similar to this, same kind of setup. They're a little bit bigger. They're a little bit more DOD based with what they're doing. But that was where I kind of cut my teeth in the UAS industry, was with them, which they've come a long way, you know, in the last few years with what they're doing. So I got to see them grow from kind of working with their engineering team, their testing, research, design, development, and then working with their training house over in Virginia and being with them for a while and getting students through and working with instructors there.
Have there been any regulatory issues at Embry-Riddle with respect to operating a program like this?
So right now we operate under Part 107 with these aircrafts, and in the future we're looking at submitting some waivers so that we can fly outside of kind of what the limits are just on the books with what they have for Part 107. So right now we're going to be flying and doing our training flights within that Part 107 limits, which are that 400 feet AGL and below, staying within line of sight. This aircraft can go very much so beyond line of sight, higher than that. So hopefully once we get that program up and running, we're going to be having those waivers set so that we can get some airspace, get some more altitude, do some different sort of camera work and beyond line of sight work with these aircraft.
That's great. Where can people go to find out more about, well, Embry-Riddle in general, but in particular these programs that we've been talking about?
Sure. So they can go to embryriddle.edu. And in there, they will have at the Daytona Beach campus and other campuses, we have UAS programs. Daytona Beach are the ones that kind of invested in these penguins. So we're doing this unmanned flight line. And that information is on that website in the catalog. And you can see the new classes and kind of descriptions under the UASS bachelor degree program.
Excellent. One of the things that we discovered or was maybe obvious when we started the podcast, I guess 5 years ago, was that many pilots in the GA community, but also commercial aviation, were a little bit leery of this drone thing.
Yep.
So here we are at Sun and Fun with a lot of pilots. Are you getting any kinds of interesting reactions from them, or are they getting used to the idea? What are you finding?
I kind of see a change in a little bit. They're kind of getting used to the idea, I think. You know, they're not just spy planes flying around. There's multi-mission, multi-roles for these types of aircraft. So the reception has been nice and kind of showing them what they can do and what the students are going to do. I mean, we're here to give those students that professional level of operations and kind of following the regs and doing everything by the book. So that's what we're looking to kind of instill in our students and make sure that the skies are safe, following those regulations, and then hopefully work in the future with the FAA to hopefully work on those, you know, sense and avoid technologies, use these as research platforms if we get more of these aircraft and kind of be able to prove that and help the risk mitigation in the future to make everybody comfortable in the skies.
Yeah, I would imagine that most of the pilots here are familiar with Embry-Riddle and the, you know, the strong reputation that it has. So I can imagine they feel kind of comfortable with the idea of people learning about how you fly drones and so forth, you know, from Embry-Riddle because of that background, because of that history. So that's good too. Have you run across any though that are just still very, you know, anti-drone and don't want to hear any more about it?
There's a couple, you know, a couple are happy that we're staying at the 400 feet. They're, you know, they don't want to see this around when I'm flying at 10,000 feet.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's becoming less and less. It's, you know, the younger kind of generation is coming up, and they're kind of accepting that this is what's going to be happening in the skies. And once you show them the technology and kind of how, you know, it's not just somebody kind of sticking rudder in it with an RC box. I mean, there is a lot of sophistication behind the software and automation of how it flies and how it's talking, and the fail safes that they have, and really the proven technologies that have been happening for years behind the scenes that people don't realize, that it really kind of comforts a lot of the pilots and people operating.
That's great. And in the end, it's all aviation, right? Yep.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Good interview.
Well, it was nice to see Embry-Riddle there. And I really was curious to learn more about what the reaction from the crowd was, because especially during the week is largely a GA crowd. But this Penguin C is an impressive UAS. This is not your, you know, hobbyist or, you know, even casual commercial drone. This is a six-figure kind of a piece of equipment that it's really impressive when you look at how it's constructed and assembled. I mean, it's all, you know, aircraft quality machined parts. It's really a nice unit. And I, you know, for a program like Embry-Riddle and the kind of education that they're trying to provide, I think this is a really, really good choice for them.
And we've come a long way, haven't we, from, I don't want to see that airplane coming through my window at 500 feet. You know, it's nice to hear from other people that what we knew all along is becoming true, that this is a different but new generation of flight. But you know what? Maybe we should talk about some more news stuff. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, let's talk about some news, David.
Well, our first one comes from theconversation.com. Drones deliver increased buzzing and noise in packages. Of course, all the positive news we had in the last story, we're going to talk about negative now. But I think Max, this is going to be one of those things we're going to be talking about a long time. Quadcopters are noisy.
They are. Largely that's because they have such small propellers generally. And as the size of the propellers or the rotors decreases, the pitch tends to go up. There's some things that you can engineer in to try to limit the noise level, but still, they're pretty buzzy. This article raises some good questions. For example, concerning the noise they produce, who sets the sound levels that are allowable and who monitors that? They point out that if you look at the promotional video for Amazon Prime Air, there is no drone sound, right? You're watching the Amazon drone flying around with a voiceover describing it, but there is no noise from the drone in the background. So the question is, what does it actually do in, you know, in the wild? And particularly if we have lots of these things buzzing around, delivering packages and whatnot.
So there's a quote in the article that says, domestic drones can raise baseline sound pressure levels by at least 20 decibels. When each 6 decibel increase means loudness doubles, that means a single drone can make an area 8 to 12 times louder than it is now. They're noisy. Propellers are noisy. Tail rotors are noisy. We've been dealing with this for years, but I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, there's an interesting chart in this article that kind of gives you a better idea for those who aren't able to relate to decibel levels. But if you look at the range, the loudness range of, for example, a commercial delivery drone, it can vary a lot depending on the drone. But it can range from a little bit under the sound of a gas-powered leaf blower to louder than a gas-powered leaf blower. Similarly, lawnmowers. Some of them can be a little bit quieter than a lawnmower, but some of them can be noisier than a lawnmower. That's pretty noisy. And I don't know. I'm not looking forward to that. But I think this is an issue that is going to have to be addressed when these things start to proliferate.
You mean an issue that has to be heard by the general public?
Yeah, right.
But What also surprised me about this list was they included things like a firecracker. That's just an instantaneous. These are persistent noises. You know, if your neighbor's using a lawn blower or a lawnmower, you know, it's a sustained, and that's where the damage gets done. So maybe the first thing these things will drop will be ears or foam ears to put in your ears, and then earplugs. So
there's a video here that we'll put in the show notes. There's some sort of an organization that's called Hiss and a Roar. And apparently what they do is sell sound libraries. And this is a video that contains part of their quadcopter sound library. And so if you really want to play some annoying quadcopter sounds, just watch this video. Because, they're all sounds that we've heard before, but it demonstrates how annoying they can be. And that'll be in the show notes.
So if you want to annoy your friends and neighbors. So, well, we're talking about drones and drones delivery. Here's who Uber's hiring to build its drone delivery service for Uber Eats. This is kind of interesting that Uber is focusing on delivering food via Uber Eats. I don't know. I haven't done Uber Eats yet. I've done Uber as the rideshare service, but I haven't asked them to deliver my food yet. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, Uber is getting into a lot of different areas. There's Uber Freight, which is a trucking and freight service. Of course, we've talked about Uber Elevate, which is hoping to provide aerial ride sharing, maybe by 2023. And now we have drones being planned for Uber Eats. And yeah, what the article has done is they've taken a look at the Uber job postings and have tracked them over a period of time. And I think there's 40 individual listings, but they include things like, you know, an airspace simulation specialist, head of public policy, urban aviation. That's interesting. Airspace systems, senior software engineer. Just a variety of job postings, human factors engineer, airspace systems, UAS flight test engineer. So they're trying to here extrapolate these job postings and speculate that Uber is planning on utilizing UAS to a greater extent. Uber has talked a little bit about this. And I guess in one case, they mentioned that they expect to begin testing this first in San Diego.
So, Uber, I'm looking for a job. Hire me. That being said, let's talk some really good news. The 2019 AUVSI Excellence Humanitarian Award. This is the second one, and it was announced at Exponential. So here are the five winners. The first one was the North Carolina Department of Transportation for using drones in an innovative response to Hurricane Florence.
And second was Swoop Aero, and that's a vaccine and health supply delivery that's on the island of, what is this, Vanuatu?
Vanuatu.
I'm not sure where that is. I'll have to Google that and learn more. Up next?
The next one is SAARUC, or the NASA MIT Search and Rescue Under the Canopy, locating people and other important targets lost in the challenging and cluttered forest areas of the United States. Thus the canopy part, not parachutes.
Right. So. And this is something that uses multiple UAS, multiple vehicles, and in an environment where there is no good GPS because of the the environment, and these things can estimate positions, map interference, plan trajectories, put these together to construct a map, basically, of a search and exploration process in the forest. And I think that's kind of a unique application.
Along the same lines was Project Lifesaver International, search and rescue for at-risk individuals who are prone to life-threatening behavior or wandering off.
Yeah, this is a search and rescue program specifically targeted towards what they call at-risk individuals, people who are, like you say, David, prone to wandering off and threatening their own safety. It says that the primary mission is to provide timely response to save lives and reduce potential injury for adults and children with the propensity to wander due to a cognitive condition. And the fifth one is one that we're very familiar with, David.
Zipline International and their medical delivery operations in Africa, which we've talked a lot about in the last couple of months. So let's talk a little bit more. This is from computerworld.com.au, so it's from down under. Surf life-saving drone maker plans long-haul autonomous UAV. The Ripper Group, I kind of like that, operates 51 Little Ripper drones in New South Wales and Queensland. In the process, they're making a larger one called the Ripper Ranger.
They've been using these Rippers to spot sharks and also to drop floats for people in distress, self-inflating floats. But this Ripper Ranger is designed to be, well, much larger and also flies significantly beyond line of sight. So, of course, it's a fixed-wing drone. And they're hoping to be able to develop and deploy this to cover much greater areas of coastline.
And the Ranger can fly up to 4 hours beyond visual line of sight. Now, in Australia, like here in the States, beyond visual line of sight is very highly regulated. So in Australia, they're in the process of working with CASA to get that down. The other part of it that's really cool that we've talked a little bit about in the past is the shark spotting option. Development with research at the University of Technology of Sydney. It has a 96% accuracy, significantly higher than the 20% accuracy rate achieved by human spotting from a helicopter. So very cool. You know, we'll give a shout out to Heather because she helped me find this one. But shark attacks in Australia is a big deal, and not wasting time in a helicopter survey for sharks is a really big deal, and very beneficial to the lifeguards and shore patrols in the island of Australia.
Another interesting aspect to this is beyond the autonomy required to fly beyond visual line of sight, they also talk about autonomous detection of people in trouble. In other words, if they're successful at this, I guess, David, they can fly the drone, patrol with the drone, and the drone itself can determine if somebody is in need of assistance. I think that would be pretty interesting, pretty neat trick if they can figure out how to do that.
Split splashing around, yeah. Or someone's in a rip current, yeah, that would be really, really, really important. So good Australia story down under. So I guess, Max, let's go to some feedback. And this was from Philip, who started off with, "Hey, guys. Can't thank you both enough for your efforts over time between Airplane Geeks and the UAV. I'm a professional aviator with 28,000 hours and an avid model aviation aficionado for over 50 years. AMA member since 1970. Good for you. David will get a kick out of this. When the Franklin Institute was redoing their aviation wing, I entered an F-8 Bearcat into the process and was selected. I have no idea if it's still there. It's been 15 years since my last visit. Well, Phil, if I ever get back there, I'll check on my models that are in the showcase and to see if yours is still there too. So very cool. But that's not why he wanted to talk to us, Max.
Yeah, he says that we share a common addiction to which there is no 12-step recovery program. And he says that AMA offers liability coverage, which is available in addition to your homeowner's or renter's insurance. So if you have no insurance, AMA becomes primary for members. And the AMA apparently has just launched a new program that provides membership free for junior members, youngsters. He says, I have that love-hate thing going on as a professional aviator and hobbyist with the disposable drone side of the house. He says, "This the new model of distribution and operation of models promotes a severe disconnect between the operator and the vehicle. When you can open a box with a perfectly trimmed and completely articulated model that requires no education or skills or community to operate at a price point that makes it disposable, we create a community who do not care to understand the liability or safety culture needed to operate these vehicles in any airspace safely." So, and I think that's true. I think partly, David, the reason why we've seen such, bad actions taken by some individuals.
Democratization of model aviation, or aviation in general. Yeah, Phil, I agree with you. Having managed a hobby shop, you took people out to the club to learn their new aircraft. And a lot of times they've had to build their aircraft from scratch. They didn't want to destroy it on their first flight, so they would go out to a flying club and stuff. That being said, we've got to keep up our due diligence and, people keep educating people and understand that the genie's out of the box and we can't go back. I do recommend, if you're on the hobbyist side, that you get a flyer from the AMA or go out to their website, because, having insurance, in case you actually do fly your aircraft into somebody else's property, is not a bad thing to have.
And Phil also comments that every one of us has a responsibility to try to bring these new modelers into the fold or risk losing our ability to fly on our own property, he says. And that's a good point. When we see folks who are new to this hobby or industry or whatever, and maybe need a little bit of direction or awareness, it really is to all of our mutual advantage to try to step in where we can. I know sometimes it's difficult. Some people don't want to have some stranger walk up to them and start telling them what they can do or not do or how to do it or anything like that. But sometimes, it's just the right thing to do. So we should all kind of keep that in mind. And, as Phil says, try to help those who need some guidance, since they sometimes don't get it. They don't have the club membership or they don't have a hobby shop to rely on like you did, David, in the past with your customers. So great points. Thanks, Phil, for writing.
And the AMA benefits page will be in our show notes as a link. So just go to the UAV Digest page and you'll see it and you'll click on it. So I guess with that, Max, we'll wrap this up. I think you're still recovering from your small little trip out west.
Yeah, I'm in kind of in a different time zone right now. But we want to thank you for listening to episode 287 of the UAV Digest. Find us at the UAVDigest.com. If you haven't subscribed yet to the podcast, we encourage you to do that. That's, of course, free. You can do that with an app on your mobile device, your phone, your tablet, whatever, iOS or Android. There's an app for that. And you can get to our show notes for this episode directly by visiting the UAVDigest.com/287.
You can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/theUAVDigest. You can find us on Twitter at the UAV Digest. And of course, you can become part of our Slack listener team, where if you join this week, you'll be able to see my new friend in the house, Zeke, and his P-40. Zeke is a Siamese betta fish that I just picked up today because I needed a new friend in my life. And besides that, so if you want to become part of the Slack listener team, you can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theUAVDigest.com. And we will send you a link and you can join it there. And of course, if you are listening on one of the podcatchers, please leave some feedback there for us. That way other people can find us. And so I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.